From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. To kick this hour off, consider all the dead cultural products that aren't dead. For instance, if you think that, say, epic poetry died after Tennyson's Idylls of the King in the 19th century, or maybe after Ezra Pound's Cantos in the 20th, check out Wikipedia. They're still being written.
And, of course, we've heard forever that movies would murder theater. Uh-huh. Anybody got Hamilton tickets? And that TV would do in radio. Hey, is this on? Huh. Turns out neither is dead yet. Or even wheezing. And I could go on. The point is, we've all heard that e-books will kill paper books. And since paper books are more profitable for publishers, that will kill the industry. Ergo, the book, dog-eared and scribbled in, that thing we grew up with, is dead.
But not so fast. It lives. Seriously, some numbers. Last December, Nielsen BookScan reported that 571 million print books were sold in 2015, a 17 million increase from the year before. What's driving those sales of paper books? And what can we expect from the publishing industry this year? When we first aired this hour back in March, I asked Carolyn Kellogg, books editor at the Los Angeles Times, whether this was the year that the myth was overturned, that e-books were going to destroy paper books.
E-books have definitely leveled off. They were predicted at one point to be about 50-60% of the market, and they seem to have leveled off at around 25%.
Paper books definitely got a big boost in 2015, but according to the AP, it's due to the rise of coloring books and books by YouTube stars. So should we be cheering?
Well, those are two very separate demographics of people who buy books, so we should. Publishing is always driven by a couple of really big hits, and the big hits usually come out of nowhere. So, like, when Harry Potter first became a big hit, books about boy wizards had not been topping the bestseller list, but then they did. And then there were lots of other books about magic. And so this past year, there were coloring books, which came out of nowhere and exist as a real alternative to your screen. They're really complex, and people are touting them as like a zen way to remove yourself from the constant Twitter, email, dinging, text messaging cycle that you get into on your phone. Or I get into on my phone.
And the YouTube stars?
Well, the people who are buying the YouTube star books are tweens. It's interesting because the YouTube stars are people with whom they have a very intimate relationship through a screen. And you wouldn't think there's anything else to share in a book, but it's a way of transporting that experience into a different kind of permanence.
You said that it's a way to further that relationship with this person you know through the screen, which speaks to the issue of just the fact that this is a physical object that you can touch. And maybe we're reacting to our increasingly digital lives by embracing the analog. You know, vinyl records are back, book sales have gone up, coloring books, you've got this intense relationship because you are actually building on the material that is in front of you.
And Johanna Basford, who's sort of the queen of the coloring books, she started them with these like Enchanted Garden and this Undersea book. She doesn't want there to be an app version of her books. She only wants them in print.
So how about audiobooks? Sales have grown nearly 40% compared to last year. So they seem to be hitting a groove.
I think their popularity is connected to the ongoing popularity and discussion around podcasts. When you start listening to something and you can get it in installments and it tells you a story and you find that satisfying, then you can go to your library and take out a library book, or you can go to Amazon's Audible store and buy the books there. I mean, Audible advertises profusely on podcasts, which sort of points me to the idea that they've found that a fruitful crossover point.
What you're saying basically is that people live in a cultural universe. And so your consumption of media in one area will directly influence your consumption in another, right?
Yes.
So what are the trends of 2016 in the current cultural universe?
Well, one of the things that I noticed is that there was this huge sort of ramping up around science fiction. All of the major houses seem to be having one new imprint that is going to make a big push for science fiction. And I think that's directly connected to awesome Star Wars. Simon & Schuster launched a science fiction imprint called Saga. Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, their new imprint is John Joseph Adams Books. And he is the longtime editor of the Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy. In publishing, we often group science fiction and fantasy together and apart from literature, but I think there's a lot of crossover. I mean, ask Margaret Atwood where her books belong. And certainly when you get to like George R.R. Martin and Game of Thrones, like people are just clamoring for his next book.
You've noted that independent presses seem to be coming on strong.
Yeah, both in terms of the people that they're publishing and the creative and ingenious works of art that they're finding and bringing into our publishing system.
How do they get their books noticed?
Well, you know, that's interesting because small publishers like New Directions or Open Letter, they're on the margins, but now they're getting into our awards slipstream. There were a couple that were finalists for the National Book Award. They've got great books. And when there's an exciting book, word of mouth is the best way to sell a book.
So how would you assess the state of publishing overall?
Overall, I would say that publishing's not dead yet. People of all ages are buying books, and they might be buying different books, but they're all walking into the bookstore or going onto Amazon and putting books in their virtual / real-life shopping cart.
Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Thank you, Brooke.
Carolyn Kellogg is the books editor at the Los Angeles Times. Three of Amazon's top 10 best-selling books of 2015 were coloring books. The Secret Garden and Enchanted Forest coloring books, produced by Joanna Basford, have together sold more than 13 million copies worldwide. A new trend? Nope.
For those who fancy coloring books.
In the Kennedy era, adult coloring books were chart toppers. Barbara Streisand's 1962 hit, My Coloring Book, riffs on the fact that sales of adult coloring books reached 1 million in 1962.
This is the heart that thought he would always be true.
But where today's coloring books are marketed as therapeutic, stress-relieving creativity engines, the coloring books of the 60s were decidedly more subversive. Laura Marsh filled in the details recently in The New Republic. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I have before me what I think is a fairly typical contemporary offering. This was given to Mythalie, the segment's producer, for Christmas. It's called Finding Peace, and it's full of swirls and flowers and birds and aphorisms. Just flip to any page and read the aphorism.
Yeah, this one looks very relaxing. It says, sometimes you can find peace of mind by transferring yourself to different situations. They're just reminders to stay calm. And that has a really lovely picture of a bird flying through a rainstorm.
So, what made the 60s coloring books so subversive?
Well, most of these books took on subjects that people were starting to criticize very vocally in the 60s and question. So corporate culture, the military, the government, sex, the hipster lifestyle. There wasn't really anything that you associate with the 60s that someone didn't make up a kind of satirical coloring book about.
Where did the idea come from?
So the first coloring book came out at the end of 1961, and it was a joke between two copywriters at a Chicago ad firm. like any good disgruntled employees, they were thinking up the most creative ways to make fun of their bosses and their jobs. So they made up this book called The Executive Coloring Book.
Mm-hmm.
And this book had pictures of an ad guy going through the stages of his day. Like, this is what daddy does when he goes to work. So the first panel, he's in his boxers, putting on his suit, and he says, "This is my suit. Color it gray or I'll lose my job."
That was the first one.
That was the first one. It was a huge hit. The first printing sold out in the first month and people started copying it in Chicago and New York. And there were like cottage industry operations out of Dallas. I think that's where the John Birch Society coloring book was
made.
Yeah,
that wasn't produced, I assume, by the John Birch Society?
No, it was specifically for the purpose of making fun of them.
And the JFK coloring book was a big one.
That was probably the next breakout hit. It spent 14 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and it made fun of JFK.
So the target of these coloring books were people who regarded themselves as cool literati types?
They were for young professional people who thought of themselves as a little bit outside the common stream. You know, we don't like bureaucracy, we don't like corporate culture, but we probably still pick up a paycheck in some of those fields.
It commodified their dissent.
Exactly.
The question that isn't answered in anything I've seen, were the books colored?
Well, the instructions in the books are often very metaphorical. So the executive coloring book said, "Color me gray," but that was pretty unusual. Most often they would say, "Color it naive," or "Color him stupid." Or like Barbara Streisand, "Color me lonely." That's not an indication to me that people were actually coloring. But mm-hmm. probably more important is that sales of crayons didn't go up.
How long did the trend last?
It was pretty much done by the time Barbara Streisand's record hit the airwaves. By 1963, I found newspaper articles where people were like, "Oh, thank God, the coloring book trend's over."
You postulate that one of the things that killed off the coloring book so abruptly in its first incarnation were the very people who created it to begin with, Madison Avenue ad execs.
Someone made a Madison Avenue coloring book making fun of Madison Avenue in this similar vein.
Making fun of themselves.
Also their bosses and their clients.
Ah.
When it hit New York City, clients started to complain and they were basically told, if you do it again, you're out.
One thing I found fascinating was that even though the coloring book was starting to crash as a cultural phenomenon, somebody found a health application for it. You saw in August 1963 piece saying that doctors were finding coloring books were useful diagnostic tools.
Yeah, I found that a worrying article. There was a doctor who had made a 12-page booklet, and he thought that he could diagnose basically any mental disorder by seeing how people colored in these squiggles. So it was like a Rorschach test, but probably even less scientific.
I'm just liking the parallel that now we see them as healthful. And back then, they were political, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're mostly healthful, but they're also somewhat political. I saw two Trump books. One is called the Trump Off-Color Coloring Book. There's also a Hillary coloring book, which makes her look kind of witchy. And there's a Ted Cruz coloring book. These are much blunter instruments and not terribly funny.
I think they're just less unexpected. I think mm-hmm. we live in a culture now where making fun of people who are in power is a pretty normal thing to do. And in the 60s, this was a completely new form of making fun of people.
The ones that are used therapeutically today, the very best ones, truly are beautiful. So it relieves stress?
It's a pretty relaxing thing for people to do at home. That was a really big contrast with the 60s because coloring now is about kind of getting away from it all, forgetting how terrible things might be or just how boring, mundane, rather than criticizing them and trying to do something about them.
Hachette Book Group is releasing a new series of books for adults, Connect the Dots.
I don't think that has the same appeal. No one liked connecting the dots as a kid. I've never met a child who's like, "Oh, I just need to get back to my dot connecting here."
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Laura Marsh is a story editor at The New Republic.
Coming up, the novelization of movies is an underappreciated art form, say its practitioners.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Back in February, an off-the-cuff remark by a giant property manager triggered some panic among bookstore owners. The tidbit from Sandeep Mathrani, CEO of General Growth Properties, was that Amazon was going analog.
You got Amazon opening bricks-and-mortar bookstores, and their goal is to open, as I understand, 300 to 400 bookstores.
Wait, what? The company that revolutionized retailing by selling books online was now going into the very business it devastated? Amazon hasn't commented, but in November, it did open a physical bookstore in Seattle, its base of operations. A second store in San Diego is set to open this summer, and in June, Amazon announced that it would be opening a third store in Portland, Oregon, right down the street from the beloved local bookstore, Powell's. Rob Salkowitz writes about digital media in Seattle. He's been in the Seattle store, and I asked him whether it was a markedly different shopping experience.
That's one of the strange things about it. A lot of these stores use their physical retail locations to make a brand statement. You know you're in an Apple store, you know you're in a Microsoft store, an REI or a Nordstrom or something like that. If Amazon is trying to do that, the store itself doesn't come across as anything better than a typical mall or airport bookstore with a good selection and no prices on anything.
Amazon opening bookstores sounds like a bad sequel to You've Got Mail.
It's a little hard to understand exactly what they're up to. First of all, as you may know, the CEO who made those remarks subsequently walked them back and said he actually has no insight into what Amazon is doing. He was sort of speculating on the basis of property leases and things like that. So it's hard to say right now what their big-time strategy is.
Amazon, in pioneering online sales, eradicated leasing costs and, as a result, simply decimated bookstores. For what possible reason would it now, in one store or 400, take those costs and limitations on?
Amazon doesn't make very much money selling books, even online. What is a money-making business is their cloud data services. What these stores are, in my view, is not necessarily a place for shoppers to find books. It's more a showcase for Amazon's data services and a way to get other retailers interested in the opportunities of bringing data into a physical retail environment.
So the company that's turned big box retailers into showrooms for its own online sales is building a showroom to showcase its own cloud and data possibilities.
Yeah, it's exactly that. When you're online and you're shopping for something on a website, they know everything about you. They know what you're looking at, how long you're on that page, what you put in your cart, what you leave in your cart, anticipate your behavior, give you offers that'll prompt you to buy more stuff. Once you walk into a physical store, all of that goes away. You're completely anonymous. So the problem that Amazon has solved at their retail location is that they don't have prices on anything. In order to get the price, you point your phone with the Amazon app running at the shelf label, and it gives you the price of that item from the website. But the most important thing is it identifies that you're you in that store looking at that item at that time. And all of a sudden, all of that data that Amazon has about you can come into play into that transaction.
But what's confusing to me is that the number of people who will ever walk into an Amazon store is a few thousand in a week. And I just took a look at their last numbers. Every day, 34 dregwillion people go online to shop at Amazon. How can the data they get from the flesh and blood humans in their brick and mortar store really make any kind of difference?
What they're actually doing is they're trying to sell the data services to other retailers, Macy's or Safeway, where you don't have goods that can ship very easily, soft goods, clothing that you want to try on in the store. All of those retailers have the same problem. They have online shoppers with information attached to them, and then they have people in their stores who could be their best customers, and they would never know it. And what Amazon has done is give you a reason to take that phone out of your pocket, to get the price, to get the information about the product, to get all of this other stuff. They actually have the customers identify themselves. And then as soon as you do that, they can offer you all kinds of additional discounts, additional incentives to make it much more likely that you will buy whatever it is you have in your hand at the store.
If it's true, is that going to be good for us as consumers or bad for us?
What they're really able to achieve is something that looks a lot like a seller's utopia and a buyer's dystopia. You know, when you walk into a store and you see prices on the shelves, the price is the price. We as consumers are used to being able to evaluate for ourselves whether that looks like a bargain or whether it looks like it's too expensive. What the retailers would love to be able to do is figure out the maximum that each individual shopper will pay for each individual good and get all the way up to that level. What Amazon's data will allow it to do is not only figure out all of the stuff that you want based on your buying history, but potentially cross-reference that with all of this other data that we are giving for free to places like Facebook and Google for using their services so that they'll know, for example, if you're motivated because you're shopping for your spouse's birthday or whether you're just there for an impulse purchase. And they can figure out exactly what set of incentives and pricing and additional offers it will get to take you to buy that one thing that's in your hand. In a sense, we as consumers would say, well, that's great. We're all being negotiated with individually. But I think there's something fundamentally unfair that the person next to me might be getting a better price than I am for exactly the same stuff because of things that the company knows about them that is going to make them buy it at that price instead of the price I'm willing to pay.
It's called dynamic pricing, and it is sort of digital age stuff. It's also the oldest retail model in the world. I mean, it goes back to the bazaars of thousands of years ago. It's not necessarily dystopic.
It's not necessarily dystopic, but it's something that's been very hard to do at scale. I don't think that Macy's wants to empower every one of their sales associates to haggle with customers over the cost of, you know, a pair of running shoes or something like that. So what this does is it lets you bring that individual personalized sales model at scale for a global retail giant. Airlines and a lot of other companies that sell you stuff primarily online are doing this all the time. This allows them to bring that into a physical environment if they'd like to. And I would like to emphasize that when I was at the store, I asked the people if they were doing that, and that was the one thing they said, no, we're not doing that at this time. But they could.
All right, Rob, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Rob Salkowitz writes about digital media in Seattle. He's the author of Comic-Con and the Business of Pop Culture. When we first aired this show, we asked Amazon for a response, and were told by a spokesperson that, quote, we don't comment on future plans. It seems that we all might do well not to speculate too much about future plans when it comes to the publishing industry. Take the strange case of movie novelizations, which were supposed to die with the advent of VHS, because, after all, why read the novel if you can watch the movie over and over? And now we are in an era of ubiquitous streaming videos, so should novelization still be a thing? Well, they're still a thing, but no more respected than ever, OTM producer Jesse Brenneman reports.
You know the experience. You're standing in an airport or the grocery store checkout lane, and you notice a glossy paperback titled, say, Batman vs. Superman. And you think, I didn't know that was a book first. And then you see the dreaded words, adapted from the screenplay. And you think, oh. And you keep moving. No, there's not much respect for the film novelization, and nobody knows it better than the people who write them.
But it seems to be the only thing that people recognize, so I usually say novelization and then in parentheses say dreaded term.
Max Allan Collins is author of over 30 novelizations, including Saving Private Ryan, The Mummy Trilogy, and Waterworld. Like many authors, he's worked his entire professional life to get out from under our disdain.
The nasty and sometimes deserved reputation of being subliterature.
That you have a bunch of writers who are not good enough to write books of their own. Just take a script and type it in book form for a quick check over a weekend.
That's Lee Goldberg, author of what he prefers to call media tie-ins, including two successful series of novels based on the television shows Monk and Diagnosis Murder. Goldberg and Collins were both fed up with the contempt for a trade that employs hundreds of writers and creates stacks of bestsellers, so they co-founded the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers, or IAMTW.
Or I am a tie-in writer. You know, the Mystery Writers of America, the Science Fiction Writers of America, the Romance Writers of America, look down their noses at these books. And we thought it was time that the authors toiling in this world got some respect, also demystified what they were doing, educated other writers and the media and readers about what goes into writing a tie-in novel.
So what exactly does go into writing a tie-in novel? First of all, a lot more than just copying and pasting.
I would largely throw the dialogue and the script away because I feel that movie script dialogue and novel dialogue are completely two different things.
Max Allen Collins.
Movies have a real habit of cutting from A to C or A to D, and people are hip enough to just sort of fill that in. But in a novel, the writer is expected to tell you how they got from, you know, the forest to the city. So it's a whole different way of viewing the material.
The very first novelization I did was 12 Monkeys.
That's Elizabeth Hand, who later novelized the 1998 X-Files film and Halle Berry's Catwoman. Hand was an author in her own right, but when tackling that first adaptation, she turned to her friend and fellow novelizer, Terry Bisson.
And then I said, Terry, what do I do? How do I do this? You know, I'm looking at this screenplay and there's not a lot there. There's just a little dialogue. And he said, well, he has this great Kentucky drawl. He said, well, the first thing you got to know is that when somebody walks into a room and sits in a chair, if that's what the stage direction says, he doesn't just walk in the room and sit in the chair. He ambles slowly across the oriental rugs that are covering the polished hardwood floors. And with a sigh, he sank deeply into the beautifully upholstered velvet wing chair. And I said, okay, well, I guess I can do that.
My eyes were open to the riches of the genre when I stumbled upon the novelization of the original Star Wars film. I was an adolescent Star Wars obsessive, and the book was amazing not because it was just like the film, but because it was so different. In addition to new scenes and history, there were changes so arbitrary that they just had to have some deeper meaning. For instance, instead of the famous "a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away," the book begins with "another galaxy, another time."
Well, it was just a film. I mean, everything hadn't been codified and brought down from Mount Sinai.
That's Alan Dean Foster, author of the original Star Wars novelization, which he ghostwrote for George Lucas. And those cryptic changes that I endowed with such significance, chances are he made most of them up. Which he could do, because in 1976, George Lucas was just the director of American Graffiti, and Star Wars was not yet a multi-billion dollar industry.
Basically, it was, here's the screenplay, here's a couple of quick shots of people involved in the film. I saw about 10 minutes of rushes one day at Industrial Light and Magic. Go write the book. And I finished the book, I turned it in, George read it, said, that's fine. And that was it.
That a Star Wars fanatic like me could read Foster's book and think it was the original source material is, for novelizers like Max Allen Collins, the dream.
I run into people all the time that think, what a genius I must have been. You know, I created CSI, and I created Saving Private Ryan, and I created Air Force One, and all this stuff, which is just absurd. But I take some credit because the book was enough of a legitimate experience to them that they didn't just feel they were getting the literary equivalent of a lunchbox.
Which raises a question. Why is our admiration so contingent upon the order of the adaptation? For authors like Alan Dean Foster, it's a source of constant frustration.
It doesn't make any sense that you can take a best-selling book that sold millions of copies all over the world, like, say, Ben-Hur, extract a screenplay from it, win an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay, and everybody says that's a great piece of writing, when that's much easier to do than take a screenplay and make a novel out of it.
And plenty of novelizers have been stuck with unenviable tasks. There's a novelization of the Britney Spears film Crossroads.
Now I know that life doesn't always go my way.
It feels like I'm caught in the middle, and that's when I realize that I'm not a girl, I'm not yet a woman.
And then there are those novelizations whose very existence is mind-bending, like this one.
Ethan Hawke, Gwyneth Paltrow, with Anne Bancroft and Robert De Niro. Great Expectations.
The cover of which reads, novelization by Deborah Cheel, based on the novel by Charles Dickens, based on the motion picture written by Mitch Glazer. But the cream of the weird crop is easily the children's novelization of The Cat in the Hat, starring Mike Myers. The original Cat in the Hat begins like this.
The sun did not shine. It was too wet to play. So he sat in the house all that cold, cold, wet day.
The novelization begins like this.
The worst day ever. It really was. For starters, I was sitting in the family room, staring out the window. I mean, that's not the way I usually spend my Saturdays. But my Game Boy was taking a ride in my mom's purse, and the TV was tuned to C-SPAN. On a good day...
And yet, sometimes, less than stellar subject matter leads to the most successful novelizations. Lee Goldberg.
Elizabeth Hand wrote the novelization of the Catwoman screenplay. The Catwoman movie was a bomb with Halle Berry. The book was such a big bestseller, they talked about doing sequels to her novelization.
There was really nothing in the screenplay at all to go on with this character. So what I ended up doing, there was a character in the screenplay, a professor of catology, who tells her how she got her magic cat powers.
Elizabeth Hand.
So I ended up writing three or four little stories within the story that were drawn on different legends about cats. And I sort of held my breath to see if they would buy it.
And often, the studios don't. As Max Allen Collins learned the hard way when he found himself in the unique position of writing the novelization for the 2002 film Road to Perdition, based on his own graphic novel.
I sat down and I wrote 70, 80,000 word novel, very faithful to the movie script, but filling in things from the graphic novel. And they came back to me and said, we want nothing in here that isn't in the script. Nothing. And it was my characters. They were not allowing me to do anything with my characters. That was a very unhappy experience.
So why do they do it?
Sebastian Fox and William Boyd are literary novelists, and yet they pandered to do a James Bond novel? Why?
Lee Goldberg.
Well, it's James Bond. A lot of authors feel the same way about Star Wars or Star Trek or the X-Men or Bunk or whatever. They want to have a chance to write those characters that they love, to explore those worlds.
For Max Allen Collins, it helps to remember who his intended audience is.
I did Waterworld. I don't know if I want to know the 55-year-old guy that picked up Waterworld and read it. I'm not really sure I want to hang with that guy. But the 14-year-old who read it and wrote me a letter about it, you know what? He's going to grow up. He's going to be reading all through those years. And if he loved my book, I got a customer.
Plus, you know.
Writers always need money.
Elizabeth Hand.
Samuel Johnson said, no man but a blockhead ever wrote except for money.
Beethoven didn't sit around turning out symphonies for fun.
Alan Dean Foster.
They're all done in commission. They're all done to be paid. And Rembrandt sat around painting fat businessmen all day. And I don't think that that's probably what he wanted to paint all the time.
And as you dive further into the history of novelizations, something else starts to become clear. The relationship between films and books is not always so straightforward. The first hit novelization was 1932's King Kong, which was released as a promotion before the film. Fritz Lang's classic Metropolis was based on the novel written by his wife, Thea von Harbau, which she wrote with the movie in mind. And Arthur C. Clarke's 2001 A Space Odyssey novel came out after Stanley Kubrick's film, but Kubrick and Clarke developed the book together as a precursor to the movie. In that screenplay, there's a line that seems to speak directly to the novelizer's task.
I am putting myself to the fullest possible use, which is all I think that any conscious entity can ever hope to do.
Or perhaps, on more cynical days, it's a line from another classic.
Look, I ain't in this for your revolution, and I'm not in it for you, princess. I expect to be well paid. I'm in it for the money.
A line which is in the novelization, albeit with a few minor changes. For On the Media, I'm Jesse Brenneman.
Coming up, one man who stole books one by one and another who literally sells them by the foot.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The thingness of books is an experience of sight, smell, and feel, as well as mind. How much more intense when a book is old, when it holds the author's own era within its faded bindings. That's why people obsess over old books, and sometimes why they steal them. Most steal to sell, but one of the nation's greatest book thieves stole for a sense of place. Basically, John Gilkey longed for a rich man's library, and he has spent his life armed with stolen credit card numbers and punctuated by stretches in the slammer to steal what he coveted. In her book, The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, Alison Hoover Bartlett traces Gilkey's reign of thievery throughout the West and his apprehension by an equally obsessed rare book dealer turned amateur detective. That's fitting, because Bartlett told us when we first aired this interview in 2009 that Gilkey loved detective stories.
As a child, he watched the Sherlock Holmes movies, and he fell in love with this idea that you could be a gentleman with a grand library and that people would be impressed by this. And so his goal was to convey to the world just how cultured and erudite he wanted to be.
And yet his books didn't follow any particular pattern.
No, he did steal books that he had read that he liked. Sometimes they were mysteries or detective novels or 19th century novels. And then he shifted to following a list from the Modern Library. It was the list of the best 100 novels in the English language. A lot of collectors follow lists. Where he's really different is that he stepped over to the dark side as the bibliodick, or book detective in my book, described him.
The bibliodick you mentioned, arguably the Sherlock Holmes of book thievery, is a Salt Lake City bookstore owner named Ken Sanders.
Well, he has a rare bookstore in Salt Lake City, but he was also working as the security chair for the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, the ABAA. In his mind, there's almost nothing more wrong than stealing books. And what would happen is when one of his colleagues would have a book stolen, they would immediately notify Sanders, and Sanders would then alert the rest of the trade.
How did he catch him?
He caught him, Gilkey, that is, by communicating with everybody to be on the lookout for certain conversations that he would have, the manner that he spoke, what he would ask for, so that at one point when one of his colleagues believed that he might have Gilkey on the line, of course, Gilkey never used his own name, he would use the name of a credit card holder, that dealer knew to contact Sanders, and then a sting was put into place with the help of law enforcement.
If Ken Sanders, his adversary, thinks stealing books is the worst thing in the world, Gilkey feels the opposite, that if he can't afford it, he deserves to take it.
He told me that when he walks into a rare bookshop and sees all these treasures there, that he almost views it as the personal property of the bookstore owner and thinks, how unfair. This person has so many books. I just want a few of them. The insurance company will pay them back. And so people are going to steal. And if you're going to have a business, you have to expect it. And those things are going to happen.
Like the weather.
Exactly.
And yet, as often is the case with addicts of any kind, the rationalization, the lines drawn in the sand, begin to slip. He regarded stealing from libraries as genuine thievery until he started to do it himself.
Yeah, it was strange. And sometimes he would describe a theft and say, because he'd have somebody else go pick up the book, well, I didn't steal from them. Somebody else picked up the book.
Tell me about Gilkey's life.
He lives in San Francisco. It's a far cry from the sort of house with a grand library that he dreams of. For a while he was on parole in San Francisco, and he still is, by the way, I think through this year, he was living in a little flea bag motel. And he's never held a job for very long. He has a degree in economics, but he instead chooses to work for stretches in part-time jobs in retail usually. He spends a lot of his days going to the library, doing research about books. He's always got a big file with him with notes of books that he's thinking of getting, as he said, he would never say steal, and writings that he's doing. He wrote an homage to one of the authors whose books he's stolen, John Kendrick Bangs. He wrote a play based on that man's work. So he's writing and reading a lot, and that was one of the qualities that I admired in him. Here he was, clever and hardworking and ambitious and curious, and I always thought if he could only apply these attributes to something worthwhile or at least legal.
You remember having an odd reaction when describing Gilkey's life of periodic arrests to a friend, and she responded, "How sad."
Yeah, I realized that it wasn't actually all that sad, that he was making progress with this goal. He was slowly amassing a large library. He was interrupted frequently by these stints in prison. But, you know, he got a great deal of satisfaction from the pursuit of the collection. And while it may look sad and certainly angers a lot of people the way that he's living, I think he has achieved some measure of success along the way.
This is a man who, in the pursuit of his criminal occupation, has enrolled in college courses to study existentialism, who's studied Iris Murdoch, who's become an expert in his field. Some of the best parts of who he is, one could argue, come from the worst parts.
Yeah. You know, the first time I met him was in prison. He was dressed in his orange prison garb and seated behind a plexiglass window. We were in one of those booths. And yet there he was discussing the 19th century novels that he had stolen. And I thought this juxtaposition of the bookish and the criminal was just fascinating.
Allison, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Allison Hoover Bartlett is author of The Man Who Loved Books Too Much. So to end this hour, we consider not the death of books, but their afterlife. That is, what to do with a book that no one is ever likely to read again. You could pulp it, of course, but there are other options. For instance, when a book's useful life ends, maybe it could finish up by essentially playing a book. What I mean is, maybe it could land in the hands of a team of bibliotriage artists who make a living prolonging the shelf life of books that have long outgrown their readers. Bob explains.
In a former post office sorting center in Frederick, Maryland, this is the sound of rescue. It's a packing machine sending thousands of used and unsold new books off to welcoming owners every day, sparing countless pages, the pulping machine, or the landfill. In this three-acre warehouse, a staff of 50 labors to find new homes for the 4 million volumes that have landed on its 21 loading docks from publishers, charities, and just plain civilians downsizing or uncluttering or otherwise divesting their libraries. Chuck Roberts, founder and president of Wonder Books, shows me cartons upon cartons of the abandoned.
So what you're looking at are just boxes of what we call raw books. These books need to go and be sorted or triaged according to a pretty complex formula that's evolved here over the last 15 years since we've been on the internet. Trying to maximize the value of every book, try to get it to the right place to turn it into a nickel, a dime, a dollar. We have the retail stores where we sell books. We sell books on the internet through about 15 different selling platforms. We sell bulk books to people that send them overseas.
Oh, and one more channel. It's called Books by the Foot, a sales segment that depends not on literary depth, but on width. It was a niche Roberts discovered by tracking sales at his 3 used bookstores.
I would notice people buying books, and it turned out there were interior decorators that were buying books for clients by look or by subject, and they would buy them from us in the stores. And then I said, well, let's work around that, and then you can buy books from us less expensively than pulling them off the shelves and buy them in bulk.
Bulk? Words. Now, before you get all huffy about the commodification of culture, Roberts wants you to know his motives aren't entirely pecuniary.
These are books that we can't sell to readers or collectors, and if we can't do something with them, at a certain point, we get filled up and they have to go to bad places. So
they have to go to the farm?
Yeah, your books are going to the farm.
Does it bother you when these things get pulped?
I can't stand to destroy a viable book.
Now, you understand that they're paper and they don't have feelings.
Well, I have feelings. And also, it's financial, too. If I can turn these 400 pallets of books into, you know, if I pay a nickel per book and I turn them into a dime, then with that kind of volume, you're talking about a little bit of money there.
But who exactly is he nickel and diming? Well, there are the TV and film sets, such as Sleepy Hollow and Hannibal and Woody Allen's Irrational Man. There are she-she retail stores trying to affect a certain sophistication, model homes for that lived-in look, and for that expensively educated-in look, professional offices.
There's no viable use for law books except decorative anymore. But someone rents a law office, it has a bunch of empty shelves on it, they wanted something to fill it in, then they can buy law books from us by the foot really inexpensively.
And then there are the individual homeowners who wish to project a certain bulk sophistication. Roberts remembers one customer who was furnishing a new beach mansion in Delaware via her New York interior decorator, a man, of course, called Helmut. The owners were entertaining on a Thursday. Helmut wanted a stocked library by Monday. 200 feet of solid literature rush. And he is not alone.
I think it's a really useful service.
New York interior designer Bradley Stevens.
I think that a room doesn't feel finished without books. It really does personalize a space.
Personalize, yes, but not necessarily by his clients personally. It's his job to plumb their tastes, values, aesthetics, and psychology to get just the right effect.
Even if they haven't read them, maybe it's aspirational, and maybe that's okay. Even if they're props, they are still books.
The concept of one-stop shopping is hardly new, nor the idea of showcasing your personal scope and erudition via your library. Book spines can tell your guests just what kind of individual you are, or wish to be perceived as. Let's face it, those Great Books of the Western World series didn't originate in the insatiable demand for Aristophanes. What Wonder Books pioneered is the system for recycling unwanted books, and of course, the novel metric. Hitherto, the accumulated literary output of man was not measured in linear feet. $5.99, by the way, for trade paperbacks, $350 a foot for premium leather. I asked Chuck Roberts about tape measure economics.
Let's say you get a copy of Catcher in the Rye and Night by Elie Wiesel and The Incredible Lightness of Being by Milan Kundera. These are very slender volumes, and that's three books. And one James Patterson is twice as thick.
Well, you pretty much hit the nail on the head with those titles. The first three titles you said would probably never make it to Books by the Foot because those sell too well in the secondary market. Those would go to our stores or on the internet. And the James Patterson, he is so overpopulated in the secondary market because he's so hugely successful that we probably get 10 copies of all his bestsellers for every one that we could sell as a book to a reader online for 15 cents in the store for a few dollars. So what are we going to do with the other 9 out of 10 James Patterson books that come in? We don't want to pulp them, so they'll go to Books by the Foot.
An immortal, in other words, if not of literature, then of interior decor.
He'll be on display and on people's shelves as a book-shaped object for a long time.
In a sorting area, an employee named Kelsey was putting together a custom order. I asked her about the oddest request she ever got.
I don't know that I've had too many odd ones, but we do get a lot of exotic colors like clay and lemon yellow and lavender, things like that.
Lemon yellow. Wait, like to match the drapes? Whereupon Chuck escorts me to a large room at the back of the warehouse. Rows and rows, stacks and stacks, arranged not alphabetically or even by the Dewey Decimal System.
Wait a second. I am in a room. Here's the signage. White and cream, earth tones, red, green. I'm a big reader. Really? What do you like to read? Orange. Is there a Sherwin Williams Prize for Literature?
No, I don't know about that.
What about the Legoization of literature? Books have been used as building blocks for furniture, art, even actual buildings. They have decent R value for exterior wall insulation, and there's always the energy sector. You know Fahrenheit 451. Those things totally burn.
I said the books, Montag! That's good. That's what I like to see.
You know what? Never mind. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Micah Loewinger, Emma Stelter, and Isabel Christo. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.